performance of His Last Days earlier this year. And don't worry, I'm not going to bring up what happened with the music or the slides. That's for a different day. But I remember during the scene when Jesus is being tried and accused of so many crimes, and He stands there offering no response. And I've sat through that scene, or stood through that scene on the risers countless times. But this year, I was standing there on the risers thinking how, if something like this were to happen today, what kind of words would be used in a trial like this? Angry mobs chanting for the condemnation of a fellow human being or human beings seems like it's something prehistoric, or at least it used to seem that way. When people recognize the humanity of others, this looks pretty barbaric. Those of us playing the angry mob doing the shouting during the musical performance are in the unique position of knowing the humanity of Jesus, that He is, in fact, God in human flesh. But we're portraying people who have stripped Him of His humanity, at least in their own minds. Only when this happens does a human begin to justify such behavior. Those arguing for and against Jesus in a modern trial, were it to take place today, might likely accuse each other of spreading fake news and post their condemnation of fellow humans on the other side all over social media regarding the people who didn't see it the same way they saw it, which was the true way. Being skeptical of journalists and referring to things as fake news is something that I can certainly understand where it's coming from. Journalists have their motives, we have ours, and the leaders of the world have theirs. And sometimes there is a space where the interests of all those parties overlap, as narrow as it may be. Unfortunately, it's seldom the goal of all these parties to seek that space at the same time. About 7 years ago, I was scheduled to meet with my cardiologist down in Cincinnati. And though I don't have any symptoms of heart disease, I have a condition that's rarely diagnosed. Most of the doctors I talk to say that the condition is rare, but I push back a little bit on that and tweak them to say, the condition, we don't know how rare it is, but we know the diagnosis is rare. If people don't have symptoms, how many of them are going to seek medical help and therefore get a diagnosis? We don't know, after all, what you don't know. Because the number of patients with a diagnosis is low, the condition is not well studied by most doctors. There are a few experts around the country who do study it. One of them at the time happened to be in Cincinnati, and that's why I was going there. A few days before my appointment, the hospital called and asked if I would be willing to be the subject of a TV news story about my visit. It would be part of a larger story about the cardiac unit at this hospital and the kind of research they are doing on these lesser-known conditions that they study. My mind went in a million directions because I value my privacy, but there was potential to raise awareness of the condition in the program that was studying it. But I didn't want to do it. When it came to the media, this wasn't my first rodeo. While there was nothing really controversial about the story, I remembered a painful lesson from the past about surrendering control of my story to those whose interests may not totally align with my own. When it came to a matter of my own personal health, it was one thing to temporarily take myself out of the driver's seat and let the medical team take over for a little while. But now I moved to the back seat while the medical team, the hospital PR department, the press, and others would all take turns driving and doing all the navigating. This was a little too close for comfort to me and a little too much loss of at least what was my own personal perception of control over the situation, so I declined. I couldn't stop thinking about a previous interaction with the press that, for right or wrong, tarnished my perception of their integrity as an industry. It had left me feeling frustrated and personally embarrassed. None of it was intentional, but it was the product of handing over editorial control of our narrative to those who may not be aligned with our interests. I'm going back to the evening of Wednesday, March 8th, 2006. 2 days prior, the Toledo Diocese had hired some low-rent muscle to run one of our vigil participants out of the old St. James building and then padlocked the doors shut. Many of you remember it well. He posted no trespassing signs, which threatened that violators would be arrested and prosecuted. time, St. James had been enjoying a very healthy relationship with the local and even the regional press. We were on a first-name basis with a lot of reporters from the Advertiser Tribune, Review Times, the News Messenger, and the Toledo Blade. Even a few from the Toledo TV news networks knew us, especially 13ABC. Shortly after the bishop's new employee left, I went over to the house and I returned to the church with my camera. Took pictures of the lockdown church, making sure that the threatening signage was very visible in each of them, and I posted them on the St. James website. And then I contacted all of the members of the media that were in my email address book. It wasn't long before the phone began to ring and the emails started pouring in. And I think Jenny and Jim probably had a similar experience as well. The calls came from all over. People all over the state and from around the country wanted to know, what were we going to do next? The parish planned an evening candlelight vigil 2 days later. The weather was cooperative, the turnout was high, and the evening sky was clear. St. James parishioners, members of United Parishes, local community members, even clergy from other denominations such as the Kansas Methodist Church and the Hopewell Church of God were there to show solidarity. The space that remained was filled with news trucks, reporters, and too many cameras for me to count. I was asked to facilitate, so when it was time to begin, I said a few words of thanks for the show of support from the community and how humbled I personally was by all of it. The candles all flickering in front of me seemed to light up the faces of everyone on an otherwise dark street. When I paused between sentences, the sound of clicking cameras filled the otherwise very quiet and solemn scene. We had conducted a prayer service that evening, very similar to the ones we had been holding inside prior to the lockdown. We sang, passed the peace, shared bread, and heard a few other members of the surrounding communities that wanted to speak about what our community and our story meant to them. Instead of a reflection, I read from several of the letters and emails we had received that week expressing support. One of them had expressed how the writer felt that Satan had won a victory over our community. It was certainly something I had considered if this move by the diocese had succeeded in shutting down our will to continue as a community of faith. The service lasted about half an hour, and when we were done, some reporters talked to attendees and went on camera to record their summary of what had taken place. It was an incredible event. I'll never forget it. We didn't know where things were headed at the time, but I felt very strongly that everyone there had just seen a moment that was very authentically St. James. There was no posturing, no pretense, no drama, just a peaceful vigil conducted by a peaceful family of faith. We watched the evening news live for each of the networks that carried it. And the amount of coverage varied from network to network, but the time devoted to it was generous. The next day, the print editions of the newspapers were carrying the story. The local papers gave very accurate accounts of what took place, but there were articles popping up from newspapers around the country that were much shorter, had a lot less detail, and contained one particular line that made my eyes pop wide open when I read it. The line said, "Steve Johnson led the crowd in denouncing the bishop for conducting the work of Satan." I was even more surprised to find out that this statement was crafted from the article printed in the Blade that morning. We had an excellent relationship with the religion editor of the Blade, so I was astonished because this didn't sound like the kind of thing he would write about me or about our church. He was always fair in his reporting to all sides in our ongoing struggle with the diocese, but he also understood what our point of view was very clearly and represented us very accurately and authentically. He had been out of town that evening, so the Blade had arranged for a freelance reporter from the AP to cover the story instead. And since his story was the property of the Associated Press, other newspapers were using and editing that same story in their own editorial departments. The desire to print something provocative and attention-grabbing outweighed our desire to be represented fairly. Oh my goodness, I thought. My friends and co-workers who have nothing to do with this are going to read this. My relatives and people that I grew up with living hours away might read this. What have I done? What will people who don't know us think when they read these words about our vigil? What will they think of our church? What will they think about me? Am I going to get asked about this? And if so, how much am I going to have to clarify what this was about? Nothing, fortunately, ever came of it. So I got worked up over nothing. But I began to appreciate just how wide the gap was between being a consumer of the news, being a publisher of the news, and being a subject of the news could be. Surely this gap is massive enough to allow plenty of room for any of those parties to act in a way that another party would not consider fair. If I wanted to accuse them of publishing fake news, I certainly could. But at the end of the day, I determined that the authenticity of this community and its desire to do what we believed was true to our identity would always win out over any temporary perception or narrative that was published in newspapers. And as Luke says in the Gospel, for where your treasure is, there also your heart will be. It was important that if the amount of exposure we were receiving back in those days were suddenly to expand, that we not lose sight of where our treasure and our hearts must reside. Not in newspapers or on television, not in arguments about who was right and wrong in our struggle with the diocese, but here with our community, taking the time to open our hearts and condition our minds to listen to what God and what Jesus wanted us to do with the community that we were saving through that faithful vigil that evening. Indeed, there are acts going on today that are shocking and upsetting, and in some cases, very recently, very horrifying. And many people will fight it out about these things in the public square, and in the media, and on television, on their Facebook pages, or their personal websites, and personal blogs. That was not the path that St. James took to get us where we are today. According to social scientists, in our country, most people fall into one of three categories when it comes to their community situation. We have one, the mobile, two, the rooted, and three, the stuck. The mobile are people who may move frequently because of job changes or a desire to have variety in their living situation. The rooted are those people who elect to just bloom where they are planted and stay where they are. And the stuck are people who are where they are, but if they could leave, they would. But they can't, so they stay. The number of people who are rooted continues to decline with each passing year, and there's evidence of it all over this country. Towns and communities, small cities, all dot the landscape in every state, showing signs of decay, of abandonment, of once thriving businesses now closed. Those who left changed from being rooted to being mobile. Those who didn't became stuck. People will look for political solutions to these problems and argue endlessly the same tired old arguments about who's to blame for this. Amidst all of this noise, very rarely will you hear any kind of a solution that speaks to the concept of building community. Communities are very easy to tear apart. They take years of hard work and commitment to build. We knew that, and we knew what we had here with St. James, and we chose to maintain it. Among the mobile, many go to cities. Los Angeles is the second largest city in the United States, population-wise. It's also the city with the highest number of residents who do not consider Los Angeles home. And what do I mean by home? Well, when there's a death in the family, or a wedding, or some other significant life event, most people, they say, they are going home to be with their family during something like this. For many people who live in Los Angeles, more often than not, going home means getting on a plane out of LAX International Airport to go somewhere else to be with their loved ones. For us, home is here. Where do you call home? May we have the courage, St. James Church, to be the builders of our community when we see this pain and suffering that we see so much of on TV. Forget about the politics of it. Arguing with the politicians and the candidates for office probably will get us no further than arguing with the bishop did, or arguing with the Holy See when it came to taking care of our community. When we see suffering in our community or around Ohio or around the country, we don't have time to wait for politicians to figure it out. We need to do authentically what St. James does. His last days depicts an angry mob shouting for condemnation. St. James held a vigil for one brief moment in front of the country and did the exact opposite. And our community lives today. But where our treasure is, our heart will be there. We open our hearts and condition our minds to listen to what Jesus wants this community to do. That is faith. And with faith comes hope. And hope ends despair.